And welcome to Courage Cocktail Radio Show. I'm your host, Leanne McClymont. I'm so glad you could join us today here at WCOM LPFM. Well, in our studio today, we have two guests whom I've been working with and invited a few months ago. You know, part of the value of community radio is that we're able to take our own time and to investigate and to consider what's going on now and what happened in the past and get a sense of updates. Well, our region was rocked back in November by an article by our friend Dan Kane. Friend, in quotes. He certainly is a companion, a friend of mine, but the story that he broke in the News and Observer, a Raleigh newspaper, really uncovered an unsettling amount of information about the academic programs and the relationship that academics and athletics have at UNC Chapel Hill. So we decided to study this story and keep our finger on the pulse, so to speak. And now a few months have passed, and a couple of books have been written, or one specific book, I should say, written by Jay Smith. And his book is called Cheated, the UNC Scandal. And we wanted to continue studying what was going on, and I thought the best thing to do was to invite the author, Dr. Jay Smith, in, as well as his team, which is studying the Athletic Reform Group, and include them in a conversation that gives us an update about what's going on since the book, but more importantly, what sense of direction this new information is going to lead us to. So let's discuss some solutions to a problem that exists. And it's certainly not a local problem, only a local problem. But we wanted to spend the hour to brew a very courageous cocktail and to think about the power of voicing dissent in an academic community and how that truth can often be extremely isolating. So I want to welcome into the show, the studio today, Jay Smith. I'll give you a background here. He's a professor of European history at UNC for 25 years. In 2001, as the university continued to struggle with its developing athletic academic scandal, he founded an ad hoc faculty group that would later come to be called the Athletic Reform Group, ARG. Several charter members of which are joining him today, actually one individual. The ARG continues to press for meaningful reforms to the big-time sports culture, as manifested here at UNC, well, I would say at other places too. A former athletic department whistleblower, Mary Willingham, in a book titled Cheated, the UNC Scandal, The Education of Athletes and the Future of Big-Time College Sports, published by Potomac Books. Now our other guest is Professor Rudy Colorado Mansfield. He is a cultural anthropologist who's been on faculty at UNC since 2008 and currently serves as the chair of the Department of Anthropology. He was an undergraduate at UNC in the class of 1987. Before returning to Carolina, he taught at the University of Iowa for 10 years and did doctoral work at UCLA, two other large public research universities that also take pride in their own athletic programs. Gentlemen, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Leanne.
Thanks for having us.
Okay, so we know, Jay, that was a big, long introduction. Jay, let's go through a few of these things, really for the benefit of our listeners, many of whom are not local, but have some clues to what this topic is at all about. So maybe you could help us, give us the background of the academic dilemma uncovered by Daniel Kane and that ensuing controversy.
Sure. Well, the UNC scandal started, it's useful to recall, not as an academic scandal, but as a more conventional impermissible benefits scandal on the football team back in the spring of 2010 because of some tweets that a star football player, Marvin Austin, had sent from a hotel room, I believe in Miami. The NCAA was alerted to some seemingly impermissible monetary benefits to which he'd been given access. And so they started an investigation of the football program. And in the course of that investigation, in which UNC participated as a partner, UNC officials discovered that some football players had evidently also been receiving impermissible academic benefits from some of the tutors in the academic support program for student athletes. And it wasn't for really a full year, not until the summer of 2011, a full year after the scandal first began to hit the newspapers, that the community began to understand the depth and breadth of the academic problem that that we now know is really the essence of the UNC scandal. Members of the academic support program, that is staff members, academic counselors who reported to coaches and to athletic directors, were evidently steering football players and other athletes into sham courses that were offered in the African and Afro-American Studies Department that had been set up by an administrative assistant and the department chair in that department, at least in part, to alleviate the burdens placed on athletes and to provide them shortcuts to academic credits. And after years of investigating, we now know, since the Weinstein report came out last fall, we now know that there were hundreds of such courses, thousands of student enrollments in these courses, and athletes were disproportionately enrolled in those courses. And so it was a general academic breakdown in the infrastructure of the university, and athletics took disproportionate advantage of those academic breakdowns.
Well, that describes a whole ton of paper, pounds and pounds of paper in a couple of minutes, and I'm grateful, and I know our listeners could see the value of that framework. But Jay, what happened next? What happened next for you?
Well, you mean how did I get drawn into this?
Yeah,
how did you get
involved?
I got involved mainly because I think in 2010, I had just recently left a position as an associate dean in the College of Arts and Sciences, in which I had helped to usher in a new general education curriculum. And so I had my finger on the pulse of the college curriculum in a way that few people do, probably, or few people did in 2010 or 11. And I was sensitive to apparent subversions of that curriculum, I think. I was just sensitive to questions of academic integrity generally speaking. And when I noticed that the administration, Holden Thorpe, the chancellor at the time, and other deans seemed not to be fully forthright in their explanations of what was going on, I began to ask questions. First, I posed questions to administrators. I went to see Holden, and I went to see the dean, Karen Gill, and I went to see other critical players in the administration, and I asked questions, and I generally found that they weren't providing very satisfactory answers to those questions. And so I started speaking out publicly. Dan Kane, our mutual friend at the News and Observer, came to me at some point in the summer of 2011 and asked for some comments about a particular plagiarism case that he was writing on, and I spoke up. And, you know, before I knew it, I had sort of become, the, for better or for worse, the face of faculty dissent at UNC. And in the fall of 2011, in the wake of a number of revelations that I found very troubling, I contacted about 10 faculty I thought would be like-minded, and I asked them if they wanted to get together to talk about how the university was handling this scandal. And that initial meeting in the fall of 2011 launched what would become the Athletic Reform Group, and we've been meeting intermittently ever since. And the Athletic Reform Group has become, I think, an important voice in the campus community that has, you know, taken as one of its objectives keeping administrators honest about what they're doing, about what they're trying to do, about what the problems facing the university really are.
We need to understand that you were given a degree of protection because at this time you had tenure. I'm assuming. Right. Okay. Right. Now, listen, you can't see this, but when Jay was describing, yes, I became the face of this particular inquiry, you had a very winsome smile on your face. Very, very winsome. Now you're smiling because you recognize, you know, and many of our listeners are not part of an academic community, but the value of tenure is that it allows you to fill in the blank.
Sure.
From your experience.
Mm-hmm. Yes. It was very important that I had tenure. Coincidentally, in 2011, when I first started speaking out publicly, I had also just recently published a book that I'd been working on for about 6 or 7 years. Mm-hmm. So I had a sense of closure with a project I'd been working on, and I felt liberated to step forward and to exercise my citizenship rights at the university in ways that I had not before, because I'd finished this book, I was tenured, I was a full professor. And if tenure is not for this purpose, to speak out when you see problems and great issues staring your institution in the face, if it's not for that, then what's it for? And so, yes, I began speaking out with a certain gusto, but also freedom to do so, and that was important.
That describes a maturity of a level of self-control. Because I do think that from this book that you wrote with Mary, mm-hmm. it's co-authored, Mary Willingham, describes this level, I can't believe this, we're going to go as an academic, very slowly, very thoughtfully, it plods along. This is not a criticism of the book, mm-hmm. but it's clearly well-researched, and there's two stories in this book. One of the stories is the scandal itself. The other story is the cover-up.
Right.
And I thought it took enormous maturity, human maturity, to place the first one first and the second one second.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
So maybe I know you've explained this to us now, how you found this voice, how you spoke with your truth. And there was fallout, I'm sure, for you to unravel this.
Sure. Sure. I mean, the fallout continues. Although I don't want to make myself a martyr. Right. I have plenty of friends at the university. I feel a lot of support at the university. And I haven't been persecuted exactly by any administrators. So I want to make that clear. I would say the fallout has been more, much more subtle. And it comes in a feeling that I'm not welcome in certain places anymore, and that my voice is not particularly welcome any longer, and that some of my colleagues just wish that I would shut up and go away. So it's a you know, very subtle sense of feeling of alienation.
Sometimes it's not so subtle.
Oh, well, now with that, you've made the perfect segue there, Rudy. You did bring a friend along
yes.
with you.
I need them.
Yeah.
And I'm very glad that you
one
are
one of
here.
Many.
One of many, exactly. Now, Rudy, I'd like to ask you, I know you're fairly new to the community of teaching, 2008, but you're an undergraduate from Carolina, class of 1987.
Correct.
So you're a true Tar Heel.
Well, I'll be Tar Heel dead. I was actually born in Massachusetts.
Oh, really? Yeah. I'm from Massachusetts?
Yeah.
I was born in Milton, raised in Canton.
Yeah, I'm from the North Shore of Massachusetts.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, yeah. So neither one of us can really claim this Tar Heel bloodline.
No, not without annoying people.
You know, I need to ask you, can you weigh in on this? You know, we're trying to understand. We clearly got the inside the ringleader, so to speak. But what drew you into the ARG, and what drew you into this very controversial and potentially lethal, politically lethal topic?
So I'll talk through how I got connected with the Athletic Reform Group. And it comes from my experience as a teacher and the difference between how I could teach the students who were on varsity teams in my class in the late 90s and what I feel is offered to them now. And so in my first tenure track job was at the University of Iowa. And I taught a course, The Economic Anthropology of the Rural Third World, which really could have been a snooze, except that it, for some reason, it attracted a lot of printmakers. I don't know why. They had a wonderful printmaking program. And then and then people who wanted to understand world poverty. And so one of the students in the class was a gymnast. He was on the team. And he was a very thoughtful person. He just asked question after question. He was very energetic, especially about the question of farmers in the Andes and things like that. And finally I said, Kevin, you can go to the Andes. This university, this was Iowa, this university has research grants that send students to the Andes. And his eyes just lit up. And we worked on a proposal, and he got funded to go to the Andes. And that is a magical moment for a teacher. As good as Iowa was at that, Carolina is better. Carolina is extraordinary in its ability to fund students to go pursue an interest that, that they like. And so Kevin became captain of the gymnastics team. Kevin was actually awarded a medal by the athletic department for his citizenship as well as competing in the NCAAs. And Kevin did an honors project in Ecuador. And at one point, in fact, he was living with a weaving family. And this was, I think, one of the most important moments of the summer. And he didn't really talk about it, just his gymnastics. But they would ask him about it from time to time. And so he took a small stool that a weaver sits on, and he put it in the middle of their weaving patio. And he did a handstand on that stool and held it perfectly. And they could care less. I thought that was a really weird thing to do, and they were just going to go on with the conversation. And that really opened Kevin's eyes to the fact that the whole world didn't really care about gymnastics, but they cared about him. They were very interested in him. And so that, I felt, to me, obviously I learned a lot personally from working with Kevin, and he wrote a great honors paper. But for me, that has been my ideal for any student to walk into my classroom. I want to offer them that same deal. And Carolina has more money for student research than most places that I know of. And it really matters to the University of North Carolina to send their students out when they are able to connect with someone like me. And so I don't feel like the athletes have the same opportunity now that Kevin had back in 2001. And I feel like now when they come into my classroom, I am there to help them survive. That they're and I don't get that many athletes. I get a regular flow, but not a whole lot. And they do really hard work in my classes, but I don't feel I'm able to do right by them the way I can do with other people. And it's that sense that we ask so much of their athletic commitment that we don't give breathing room to their studies that got me worried. And then as all of the scandals broke, the thing that was really getting me anxious, and I would say upset, is that as each new story broke, at the same time we were doubling down on our athletic commitments. We were expanding the football stadium. Mm-hmm. We were expanding the ACC, and I saw all of that as just even more pressure coming to bear on these students who are playing for these teams. And it was that worry that we weren't, as a faculty, talking about all these new athletic commitments that were happening, even as the costs, that, you know, in terms of the scandal, were breaking around it. We weren't even talking about the new kinds of commitments we were making. So I would get up and I'd speak out at different public meetings, and then another person who's not here today, but a colleague, she came up and said, you know, you're not alone in worrying about that. So you need to come to this athletic reform group meeting. So that's how I wound up at the athletic reform group.
I'm sitting here stunned, and on many levels, I understand that moment when a student's mind opens, but so rarely do their feet follow, right? Mm-hmm. Let your heart carry your feet. And to have people push their feet in the right direction is sometimes all it takes. And I do think of Carolina, which I refer to as UNC Chapel Hill for our broader audience. Mm-hmm. You will hear me say that as Carolina. But the value of that is it's a public Ivy university, and for good reason, because of the standards of qualities, the commitment to growth. But I wanted to drill down to a detail that I picked up on your media links, Jay, on your website. Cheated, I think, is give us the website that I got.
Paper Class Inc.
Paper Class Inc. That's it. Yeah. Paper Class Inc. When you Google cheated, it comes up. So that's how I got there. But looking at a particular group of students, there are 800 students at the university on in athletic programs. 400 of them were on the dean's list. 200 of them are somewhere between floating, close to reaching the dean's list, not on it. And then you have somewhere between 100 and 200 students in that zone, that threatened zone of performance and things. And the reason I bring that up in this context is this, that it seems to me that we're addressing a very specific group of student athletes, not all student athletes. Or I could be wrong. Correct
well,
me.
It's true. It is true that... what Mary Willingham and I think of as the category of profit sport athletes, those who are, who play football and basically men's basketball, maybe some women's basketball thrown in too, we believe that they do face a particular set of challenges and a particular set of constraints and pressures that are distinct, that separate them from most of the rest of the athletes in that pool of 800 that you just mentioned. But as Rudy will tell you, and Rudy's very sensitive to this, the sorts of the time pressures and competitive pressures and difficult academic choices that are placed on those revenue sport or profit sport athletes are also shared by the others. I mean they're all being pinched, they're all being squeezed, they're all being asked to do things that you shouldn't be able to do unless you're a Superman or a Superwoman. And so I want to say yes and no to your question, whether, you know, the 100 or 200 athletes are in an entirely different category. In some ways they are, but in other ways they're not.
So you're saying what's in the breach here isn't necessarily a minority of these students. What's in the breach is the culture of performance. So it's really the culture at play, and that culture that's ever increasing a level of performance, athletic performance, can't help but take away from time in the classroom or in the library.
Yeah, so one of my senses of it is that, again, my usual experience with a student who's on a team is that they're anthropologists, so they're most often young women, and they are very organized and very disciplined, and they are working very hard and do well. That's my experience of the students who are on the team. But it is still the situation where they could do more, right? If they were really interested in the subject, they could do more. They could take it in new directions, and they don't have the opportunity now. So that I feel like we... You know, at each level, what happens is you'd have someone who would be capable of writing a very interesting honors project, but instead of doing that, they're just going to get very high grades. And you're going to have people who would have gotten really impressive grades. Instead of doing that, they'll get a mix of grades, but not quite what they were going to get. And so at each level, it steps down. Now, this happens to people who get interested in lots of things. I do a lot of work with students who are very interested in local food, and they start to run farmers markets and set up businesses, yes, and their grades take a hit. But those students will then at some point say, all right, I'm going to do my honors paper, and they start to reorganize their schedule, and they put their entrepreneurial thing on the back burner, and they take care of their honors paper, and then they come back to their studies. So, you know, lots of students make decisions to be really committed to an extra activity, but they also still have autonomy. That is to say, they also can kind of say, all right, this is the semester where I actually will go after my studies.
It's almost as if you restored their agency, whereas what we see happening on these teams socially with our friends' daughters, playing at different sports places, is there's a coercive community that says you didn't make practice, you know, and you're not going to be selected for this particular game to play in. There's a different culture. Yeah. The light went on in my head, Rudy, when you were saying it's not what it is that they're doing, it's that they could be so much more and contribute to this body of knowledge. And welcome to Courage Cocktail Radio Show. I'm your host, Leanne McClymont. I'm so glad you could join us today here at WCOM LPFM. Well, in our studio today, we have two guests whom I've been working with and invited a few months ago. You know, part of the value of community radio is that we're able to take our own time and to investigate and to consider what's going on now and what happened in the past and get a sense of updates. Well, our region was rocked back in November by an article by our friend Dan Kane, friend in quotes. He certainly is a companion, a friend of mine, but the story that he broke in the News and Observer, a Raleigh newspaper, really uncovered an unsettling amount of information about the academic programs and the relationship that academics and athletics have at UNC Chapel Hill. So we decided to study this story and keep our finger on the pulse, so to speak. And now a few months have passed, and a couple of books have been written, or one specific book, I should say, written by Jay Smith. And his book is called Cheated, the UNC Scandal. And we wanted to continue studying what was going on. And I thought the best thing to do was to invite the author, Dr. Jay Smith, in, as well as his team, which is studying the Athletic Reform Group, and include them in a conversation that gives us an update about what's going on since the book, but more importantly, what sense of direction this new information is going to lead us to. So let's discuss some solutions to a problem that exists, and it's certainly not a local problem, only a local problem, but we wanted to spend the hour to brew a very courageous cocktail and to think about the power of voicing dissent in an academic community and how that truth can often be extremely isolating. So I want to welcome into the show, the studio today, Jay Smith. I'll give you a background here. He's a professor of European history at UNC for 25 years. In 2001, as the university continued to struggle with its developing athletic academic scandal, he founded an ad hoc faculty group that would later come to be called the Athletic Reform Group, ARG. Several charter members of which are joining him today, actually one individual. The ARG continues to press for meaningful reforms to the big-time sports culture, as manifested here at UNC, well, I would say at other places too. A former athletic department whistleblower, Mary Willingham, in a book titled Cheated, the UNC Scandal, The Education of Athletes and the Future of Big-Time College Sports, published by Potomac Books. Now our other guest is Professor Rudy Colorado Mansfield. He is a cultural anthropologist who's been on faculty at UNC since 2008 and currently serves as the chair of the Department of Anthropology. He was an undergraduate at UNC in the class of 1987. Before returning to Carolina, he taught at the University of Iowa for 10 years and did doctoral work at UCLA, two other large public research universities that also take pride in their own athletic programs. Gentlemen, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Leanne.
Thanks for having us.
Okay, so we know, Jay, that was a big, long introduction. Jay, let's go through a few of these things, really for the benefit of our listeners, many of whom are not local, but have some clues to what this topic is at all about. So maybe you could help us, give us the background of the academic dilemma uncovered by Daniel Kane and that ensuing controversy.
Sure. Well, the UNC scandal started, it's useful to recall, not as an academic scandal, but as a more conventional, impermissible benefits scandal on the football team back in the spring of 2010 because of some tweets that a star football player, Marvin Austin, had sent from a hotel room, I believe in Miami. The NCAA was alerted to some seemingly impermissible monetary benefits to which he'd been given access. And so they started an investigation of the football program. And in the course of that investigation, in which UNC participated as a partner, UNC officials discovered that some football players had evidently also been receiving impermissible academic benefits from some of the tutors in the academic support program for student athletes. And it wasn't for really a full year, not until the summer of 2011, a full year after the scandal first began to hit the newspapers, that the community began to understand the depth and breadth of the academic problem that that we now know is really the essence of the UNC scandal. Members of the academic support program, that is staff members, academic counselors who reported to coaches and to athletic directors, were evidently steering football players and other athletes into sham courses that were offered in the African and Afro-American Studies Department that had been set up by an administrative assistant and the department chair in that department, at least in part, to alleviate the burdens placed on athletes and to provide them shortcuts to academic credits. And after years of investigating, we now know, since the Weinstein Report came out last fall, we now know that there were hundreds of such courses, thousands of student enrollments in these courses, and athletes were disproportionately enrolled in those courses. And so it was a general academic breakdown in the infrastructure of the university, and athletics took disproportionate advantage of those academic breakdowns.
Well, that describes a whole ton of paper, pounds and pounds of paper in a couple of minutes, and I'm grateful, and I know our listeners could see the value of that framework. But Jay, what happened next? What happened next for you?
Well, you mean how did I get drawn into this?
Yeah, how did you get involved?
I got involved mainly because I think in 2010, I had just recently left a position as an associate dean in the College of Arts and Sciences, in which I had helped to usher in a new general education curriculum. And so I had my finger on the pulse of the college curriculum in a way that few people do, probably, or few people did in 2010 or 11. And I was sensitive to apparent subversions of that curriculum, I think. I was just sensitive to questions of academic integrity generally speaking. And when I noticed that the administration, Holden Thorpe, the chancellor at the time, and other deans seemed not to be fully forthright in their explanations of what was going on, I began to ask questions. First, I posed questions to administrators. I went to see Holden, and I went to see the dean, Karen Gill, and I went to see other critical players in the administration, and I asked questions, and I generally found that they weren't providing very satisfactory answers to those questions. And so I started speaking out publicly. Dan Kane, our mutual friend at the News and Observer, came to me at some point in the summer of 2011 and asked for some comments about a particular plagiarism case that he was writing on, and I spoke up. And, you know, before I knew it, I had sort of become, for better or for worse, the face of faculty dissent at UNC. And in the fall of 2011, in the wake of a number of revelations that I found very troubling, I contacted about 10 faculty I thought would be like-minded, and I asked them if they wanted to get together to talk about how the university was handling this scandal. And that initial meeting in the fall of 2011 launched what would become the Athletic Reform Group, and we've been meeting intermittently ever since. And the Athletic Reform Group has become, I think, an important voice in the campus community that has, you know, taken as one of its objectives keeping administrators honest about what they're doing, about what they're trying to do, about what the problems facing the university really are.
We need to understand that you were given a degree of protection because at this time you had tenure, I'm assuming.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Now, listen, you can't see this, but when Jay was describing, yes, I became the face of this particular inquiry, you had a very winsome smile on your face. Very, very winsome. Now you're smiling because you recognize, you know, and many of our listeners are not part of an academic community, but the value of tenure is that it allows you to fill in the blank.
Sure.
From your experience.
Mm-hmm. Yes. It was very important that I had tenure. Coincidentally, in 2011, when I first started speaking out publicly, I had also just recently published a book that I'd been working on for about 6 or 7 years. Mm-hmm. So I had a sense of closure with a project I'd been working on, and I felt liberated to step forward and to exercise my citizenship rights at the university in ways that I had not before, because I'd finished this book, I was tenured, I was a full professor, and if tenure is not for this purpose, to speak out when you see problems and great issues staring your institution in the face, if it's not for that, then what's it for? And so, yes, I began speaking out with a certain gusto, but also freedom to do so, and that was important.
That describes a maturity of a level of self-control, because I do think that from this book that you wrote with Mary, mm-hmm. it's co-authored, Mary Willingham, describes this level, I can't believe this, we're going to go as an academic, very slowly, very thoughtfully, it plods along. This is not a criticism of the book, mm-hmm. but it's clearly well-researched, and there's two stories in this book. One of the stories is the scandal itself. The other story is the cover-up.
Right.
And I thought it took enormous maturity, human maturity, to place the first one first and the second one second.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
So maybe I know you've explained this to us now, how you found this voice, how you spoke with your truth. And there was fallout, I'm sure, for you to unravel this.
Sure. I mean, the fallout continues. Although I don't want to make myself a martyr.
Right.
I have plenty of friends at the university. I feel a lot of support at the university. And I haven't been persecuted exactly by any administrators, so I want to make that clear. I would say the fallout has been much more subtle, and it comes in a feeling that I'm not welcome in certain places anymore, and that my voice is not particularly welcome any longer, and that some of my colleagues just wish that I would shut up and go away. So it's a very subtle sense of feeling of alienation.
Sometimes it's not so subtle.
Oh, well, now with that, you made the perfect segue there, Rudy. You did bring a friend along
yes.
with you.
I need them.
Yeah.
And I'm very glad that you
are
here.
One of many.
One of many, exactly. Now, Rudy, I'd like to ask you, I know you're fairly new to the community of teaching, 2008, but you're an undergraduate from Carolina, class of 1987.
Correct.
So you're a true Tar Heel.
Well, I'll be Tar Heel dead. I was actually born in Massachusetts.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I'm from Massachusetts?
Yeah.
I was born in Milton, raised in Canton.
Yeah, I'm from the North Shore of Massachusetts.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, yeah. So neither one of us can really claim this Tar Heel bloodline.
No, not without annoying people.
You know, I need to ask you, can you weigh in on this? You know, we're trying to understand. We clearly got the inside the ringleader, so to speak. But what drew you into the ARG, and what drew you into this very controversial and potentially lethal, politically lethal topic?
So I'll talk through how I got connected with the athletic reform group. And it comes from my experience as a teacher and the difference between how I could teach the students who were on varsity teams in my class in the late 90s and what I feel is offered to them now. And so in my first tenure track job was at the University of Iowa, and I taught a course, The Economic Anthropology of the Rural Third World, which really could have been a snooze, except that it, for some reason, it attracted a lot of printmakers. I don't know why. They had a wonderful printmaking program. And then and then people who wanted to understand world poverty. And so one of the students in the class was a gymnast. He was on the team. And he was a very thoughtful person. He just asked question after question. He was very energetic, especially about the question of farmers in the Andes and things like that. And finally I said, Kevin, you can go to the Andes. This university, this was Iowa, this university has research grants that send students to the Andes. And his eyes just lit up. And we worked on a proposal, and he got funded to go to the Andes. And that is a magical moment for a teacher. As good as Iowa was at that, Carolina is better. Carolina is extraordinary in its ability to fund students to go pursue an interest that they like. And so Kevin became captain of the gymnastics team. Kevin was actually awarded a medal by the athletic department for his citizenship as well as competing in the NCAAs. And Kevin did an honors project in Ecuador. And at one point, in fact, he was living with a weaving family. And this was, I think, one of the most important moments of the summer. And he didn't really talk about it, just his gymnastics. But they would ask him about it from time to time. And so he took a small stool that a weaver sits on, and he put it in the middle of their weaving patio. And he did a handstand on that stool and held it perfectly. And they could care less. I thought that was a really weird thing to do, and they were just going to go on with the conversation. And that really opened Kevin's eyes to the fact that the whole world didn't really care about gymnastics, but they cared about him. They were very interested in him. And so that, I felt, to me, obviously I learned a lot personally from working with Kevin, and he wrote a great honors paper. But for me, that has been my ideal for any student to walk into my classroom. I want to offer them that same deal. And Carolina has more money for student research than most places that I know of. And it really matters to the University of North Carolina to send their students out when they are able to connect with someone like me. And so I don't feel like the athletes have the same opportunity now that Kevin had back in 2001. And I feel like now when they come into my classroom, I am there to help them survive. That they're and I don't get that many athletes. I get a regular flow, but not a whole lot. And they do really hard work in my classes, but I don't feel I'm able to do right by them the way I can do with other people. And it's that sense that we ask so much of their athletic commitment that we don't give breathing room to their studies that got me worried. And then as all of the scandals broke, the thing that was really getting me anxious, and I would say upset, is that as each new story broke, at the same time we were doubling down on our athletic commitments. We were expanding the football stadium. Mm-hmm. We were expanding the ACC, and I saw all of that as just even more pressure coming to bear on these students who are playing for these teams, and it was that worry that we weren't, as a faculty, talking about all these new athletic commitments that were happening, even as the costs that, you know, in terms of the scandal were breaking around it. We weren't even talking about the new kinds of commitments we were making. So I would get up and I'd speak out at different public meetings, and then another person who's not here today, but a colleague, she came up and said, you know, you're not alone in worrying about that. So you need to come to this athletic reform group meeting. So that's how I wound up at the athletic reform group.
I'm sitting here stunned, and on many levels, I understand that moment when a student's mind opens, but so rarely do their feet follow, right? Mm-hmm. Let your heart carry your feet. And to have people push their feet in the right direction is sometimes all it takes. And I do think of Carolina, which I refer to as UNC Chapel Hill for our broader audience. Mm-hmm. You will hear me say that as Carolina. But the value of that is it's a public Ivy University, and for good reason, because of the standards of qualities, the commitment to growth. But I wanted to drill down to a detail that I picked up on your media links, Jay, on your website. Cheated, I think, is give us the website that I got.
Paper Class Inc.
Paper Class Inc. That's it. Yeah. Paper Class Inc. When you Google cheated, it comes up. So that's mm-hmm, how I got mm-hmm. there. But looking at a particular group of students, there are 800 students at the university in athletic programs. 400 of them were on the dean's list. 200 of them are somewhere between floating close to reaching the dean's list, not on it. And then you have somewhere between 100 and 200 students in that zone, mm-hmm. that threatened zone of performance and things. And the reason I bring that up in this context is this, that it seems to me that we're addressing a very specific group of student athletes, not all student athletes. Or mm-hmm. I could be wrong. Correct
well,
me.
it's true. It is true that... what Mary Willingham and I think of as the category of profit sport athletes, those who play football and basically men's basketball, maybe some women's basketball thrown in too. We believe that they do face a particular set of challenges and a particular set of constraints and pressures that are distinct, that separate them from most of the rest of the athletes in that pool of 800 that you just mentioned. But as Rudy will tell you, and Rudy's very sensitive to this, the sorts of the time pressures and competitive pressures and difficult academic choices that are placed on those revenue sport or profit sport athletes are also shared by the others. I mean they're all being pinched, they're all being squeezed, they're all being asked to do things that you shouldn't be able to do unless you're a Superman or a Superwoman. And so I want to say yes and no to your question, whether, you know, the 100 or 200 athletes are in an entirely different category. In some ways they are, but in other ways they're not.
So you're saying what's in the breach here isn't necessarily a minority of these students. What's in the breach is the culture of performance. So it's really the culture at play, and that culture that's ever increasing a level of performance, athletic mm-hmm. performance, can't help but take away from time in the classroom or in the library.
Yeah, so one of my senses of it is that, again, my usual experience with a student who's on a team is that they're anthropologists, so they're most often young women, and they are very organized and very disciplined, and they are working very hard and do well. That's my experience of the students who are on the team. But it is still the situation where they could do more, right? If they were really interested in the subject, they could do more. They could take it in new directions, and they don't have the opportunity now. So that I feel like we... You know, at each level, what happens is you'd have someone who would be capable of writing a very interesting honors project, but instead of doing that, they're just going to get very high grades. And you're going to have people who would have gotten really impressive grades. Instead of doing that, they'll get a mix of grades, but not quite what they were going to get. And so at each level, it steps down. Now, this happens to people who get interested in lots of things. I do a lot of work with students who are very interested in local food, and they start to run farmers markets and set up businesses, yes, and their grades take a hit. But those students will then at some point say, all right, I'm going to do my honors paper, and they start to reorganize their schedule, and they put their entrepreneurial thing on the back burner, and they take care of their honors paper, and then they come back to their studies. So, you know, lots of students make decisions to be really committed to an extra activity, but they also still have autonomy. That is to say, they also can kind of say, all right, this is the semester where I actually will go after my studies.
It's almost as if you restored their agency. Mm-hmm. Whereas what we see happening on these teams socially with our friends' daughters playing at different sports places is there's a coercive community that says you didn't make practice, you know, and you're not going to be selected for this particular game to play in. There's a different culture. Yeah. The light went on in my head, Rudy, when you were saying it's not what it is that they're doing, it's that they could be so much more and contribute to this body of knowledge. They could bring forward a topic that they have passion about, and with your careful stewardship, your academic, the scholarship, which is exactly the right time at the right place, they could move so much further into knowing this they chose not to. They simply can't. Is it squandering?
So this is college, right? And what do you get out of college? And what do you try to do as a college teacher? Well, for most in your classroom, you're getting them into the habits of seeing the world as a historian or as an anthropologist, how the world looks and comes together for you. But for some, you want to change a life, right? That's that's the hope that you have in a classroom. Yeah. And that hope is, you know, is put at risk with the way that we are training these students to be really high-performing athletes. And I guess one of the things that one of the responses that I get when I worry about this aloud is that the students are choosing this, and they are, right? That they are making a choice, but they're making a choice that they have been set up to make by adults in their lives since they were 12 years old. And so that's another thing I feel like it is, you know, my job as their college professor is to try to create world and connections to teachers and connections to other students who might be like them, in which other kinds of choices are possible.
You know, you say that this is what it is you worry about, and clearly there's a lot going on, but one would argue, playing devil's advocate, that student might not have found her way into UNC had she not been an athlete. So in some ways, is this a little bit distorted in that it's one thing to say, well, you're here, you can do so much more than you're doing, not because of lack of performance, but just because of lack of time and not lack of talent. But the whole reason they may be there is because of some other gift, and a gift to play volleyball, to row a boat. So there's, I'm putting my head around this. How do I see it? How do you see it?
Well, as we say in the introduction to our book, it is certainly true that athletes get something of value from the deal, from the scholarship agreement that they sign that allows them to come to UNC Chapel Hill. They do get something of value. They get a lot of value. They certainly do. They get great coaching and the attention of trainers and nutritionists who help them become better athletes. And of course, yes, they also get the opportunity to attend UNC's classes and sample and intellectually in ways they would never been able to do had they not been given this scholarship. They are given something. But the question we ask is, are they given what they deserve? Are they given what is owed them? And I think most of us in the Athletic Reform Group believe that they are not given what they are owed, which is an opportunity to expand themselves intellectually, to explore new domains of knowledge, to find a major that excites them and can change their lives, and to envision for themselves a post-athletic life. And some do. Some of our athletes are, after all, supermen and superwomen, and they somehow manage to do all of these things. Some do. But, you know, we believe that it is unfortunate that universities place such constraints on the athletes that they recruit that most of them really are not able to do all those things. And faculty and administrators at institutions of higher learning ought to be making it their priority to make sure that every single student they bring to campus has that opportunity to grow. And right now, that's not happening.
So we know this much. When you the Wall Street Journal did a story as a follow-up of this, and you kindly sent the link on your website. 2% of these athletes in colleges playing on this Division I, 2% are recruited into the pros.
Right.
So 98% mm-hmm. go somewhere else.
Yeah.
Do something else. Have to make a life outside of the professional leagues. If I didn't know that and read that and follow it, and I did my own research and the attribution is there, it's true, I would have walked away and said, well, you know, they go on to the pros and mm-hmm. live happily after, you know, blah, blah, blah. But that's not the case. It's such an asymmetrical outcome. All these resources seem to be dwelling in the university for these sports, and yet only 2% is the yield of these pros. Mm-hmm. So when you described the post, envision a life post-athletic life, you can see why it becomes critical that their education cannot be overlooked.
Mm-hmm. Right. I guess my bigger concern is looking the other way as them as high school students and middle school students and what college means to kids who have athletic talent, and that the message we send as Carolina to students who are athletically gifted and are also in the classroom. And my worry is that people don't start to sell out their education, seeing that they are talented, thinking that they will get to college anyway on their athletic talents, and then once in college, they will be given a very heavy load of training to be an extraordinary athlete, but that but their education was limited because of the perception of their path to college and through college and beyond college. And that's what I'm mindful of too, and why I think reform is just a very important conversation.
And this conversation is going to continue. We're going to step it up a bit. When we return, we're going to pick up the thread. We're going to talk about the solutions. The ARG presents a solution to not only our university, UNC University, but perhaps the larger picture. So when we return, we're going to pick up that thread. And Rudy, I want to pick up another conversation with you, and that is the role of parents, middle school parents, kids out there, moms out there, dads, uncles, aunts. If you have middle school age children, what are we sending these kids as messages? You know, we almost got caught up in the whole volleyball thing with our kid, and fortunately, we had the wherewithal, emotional wherewithal, to back away from that. But I'm not so sure that could be said for most of us. Mm-hmm. So let's continue this, and when we return, we will be back in studio with Jay Smith and Rudy Colorado. Thank you.
WCOM, your all-volunteer community radio station in Carrboro, needs your support. Do you have an idea for a radio show? How about an interest in engineering or a computer background? Are you interested in fundraising or just meeting a group of wonderful people? Please consider a donation of time or money to support this gem of the community. To find out more, please visit our website, wcomfm.org. To make a financial contribution, sponsor your favorite show, or help support our many featured news and information programs, click the PayPal donate button at the top of our main page. Again, please visit our website, wcomfm.org, and thanks for listening to your community radio station. And if you're in the Carrboro area, the Hickory Tavern, located inside the Hampton Inn at 370 East Main Street in Carrboro, will host a fundraiser for your community radio station, WCOM LP 103.5, on Thursday, May 7th, from 5 p.m. to 10 p.m. 10% of food sale totals from receipts deposited will be donated to WCOM, a nonprofit, all-volunteer community radio station serving Carrboro and Chapel Hill. Hope to see you there.
Welcome back to Courage Cocktail Radio Show. I'm your host, Leanne McClymont. You are listening to WCOM LP, Chapel Hill, Carrboro, North Carolina. Glad you're with us today. Joining us in the studio are two guests, Jay Smith, a professor of European history, UNC, for 25 years, and also Rudy Colorado, who is the chairman of the anthropology department. Both individuals serve as faculty members of the UNC at Chapel Hill. And the reason they're here joining us in the studio is because of their work on the ARG, ARG, which is the Academic Reform Group. In case you didn't get a chance to tune in earlier, we really were outlining the whole shape, the history of this so-called scandal. And I say scandal because I think that it's a significant discovery, but I don't think that it's exclusive to this region. I think it's a cultural what we do with sports, how do we treat our students who want to continue sports, and where the university, the academy, so to speak, and athletics departments may not see eye to eye. So I want to continue the thread of conversation here, because before our break, we were talking about what the ARG is all about. And the ARG is this group that was formed ad hoc in 2011, is that right?
Right.
So let's talk about what's going on there, Jay, specifically, mm-hmm. and any measurable outcomes so far?
It's a great question. You know, I would say, and I'll be interested to hear Rudy's perspective on this too, but I would say our first objective all along has been to create a space for conversation on the campus.
Well, welcome to Courage Cocktail. That's what we do here.
Right.
This is exactly what we do.
And thank you for inviting us for conversation.
But yeah. I mean, it's safe space.
Yeah.
It's civic. It's a sense of being honest, but being safe about your truth.
Mm-hmm.
And continue on. I'm interested.
Yeah. And we, back in the fall of 2011, noticed with a certain level of discomfort that, for whatever reason, the faculty council or other likely forums at which these sorts of issues might get discussed were not being exercised in that way. And so there wasn't really a place where faculty could come together to talk about the very serious structural and moral issues that were brought to the surface by the scandal. And so that's what we have tried to do. I mean, I would say one of the most important things that we have pushed at faculty council and elsewhere over the past several years is for a series of town hall discussions on the campus that would allow all of the constituents of the community to come together to talk about the lessons that we're supposed to derive from this scandal and how we move forward meaningfully from this scandal. We've asked for that repeatedly. We've been repeatedly rebuffed, unfortunately, but at least we at ARG meetings are able to talk about these things and decide on ways to intervene in faculty council deliberations that allow at least the public record, the official record of faculty council, to reflect our concerns.
Counterpoint.
So, well, not so much a counterpoint. I think that I get the chronology muddled, but I'm going to just say the middle years of the scandal.
Okay, this is good.
That when from conversation and increasing awareness of how many courses and how many athletes were involved in this and wondering who was supposed to be responsible and what happened, that as there was increasing concern to figure that out on the campus, there was also increasing concern by other folks that we need to move on. So much so that by the end, the students had started to create a drinking game, that whenever they heard the phrase, we need to move on, it was the moment to drink. It was this tension about the need to find a direction and get going and knowing what went wrong and why and who was responsible. And as the tension grew on campus, the athletic reform group really kept getting up again and again. This is why people got tired of us, is that saying that, well, this hasn't been answered and this hasn't been answered. And the inquiry stopped with this year, but why did it stop with that year and not go past? So I think that was... it wasn't that the athletic reform group was the only group of folks who wanted the full story, but I think that was a big role that it took upon itself. Now, again, others did as well, and I think one of the things that happened with the change of the chancellor is that Chancellor Folt came in also saying, okay, let us get a bigger story. So her means of doing that was to hire Wayne Steen and his team. Prior to her arrival, though, again, it was the athletic reform group that was most consistently stepping up to say, well, what happened? I think that was one of my senses.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So can you, for our listeners, describe Carol Folt, her role, she is when she arrived? I'll throw that out to you, Jay.
Well, on her arrival in July of 2013, I know she was inundated with emails from all over the campus community.
And she is serving as the chancellor for the university.
Chancellor for the university, right. Okay. She was inundated with emails. Everybody gave her advice on what she needed to do next. And I think... I think a few people managed to get to her and they, including, but let's be perfectly honest here, including Jan Boxall, the former chair of the faculty, who was very much a supporter of the athletic program and one of the champions, I would say, of the Let's Move On caucus, if we can refer to them that way. She was very eager to get the scandal over with, put it in the past, move on to different things. And so initially, Chancellor Folt, I think, was not terribly interested in looking further at what the scandal might tell us about the athletic culture on campus or athletic issues generally. But once Julius Nyongaro was indicted in December of 2013, and it became apparent that he was likely to have to testify about his experiences as a teacher and in setting up these fake courses and so on. And also, once the chancellor learned that he was cooperating with the Orange County DA, I think she realized that this was an opportunity, finally, to get to the bottom of at least what had happened in AFAM. And it was also an opportunity not to be missed or passed up, because it would make the institution look pretty silly if it failed to find out what had happened, but Julius Nyongaro revealed in a courtroom what had happened. So she called in Kenneth Weinstein in February of 2014, and I give her credit for that. That was a pivotal moment in our scandal. The Weinstein report has helped clear the air in a lot of ways, but we're still hoping that the chancellor and the provost will resolve to do bigger and bolder things in attacking the structural issues that have come to light, thanks to Weinstein, among others.
Among others, and I include your book among others, that book with Mary Willingham. Mm-hmm. But because time is moving so fast, I'd like to ask us and ask Rudy again to help us see the Reform Group as something that might be bigger than UNC, and it might help us understand, you know, the tougher question that no one's asking you, gentlemen, is, can these two coexist? Can you have big sports and at the same time have academic standards? Can they exist? Should they exist?
So,
this is Rudy speaking.
I want to come at that a little bit from a meeting that Jay and I were at yesterday. In fact, where the chancellor was there, it was with the faculty athletic committee. And part of what I personally am working on with another colleague, Arian Waite, is trying to put more options on a table for the career paths for the students who are on teams. And I will say that the chancellor wants those options on the table to be talked about. I felt that was encouraging at the meeting yesterday. She wants us to take a big look at what's going on. Probably not quite as big as Jay's set of ideas. Jay's really got a big look, but I feel like the chancellor wants the conversation to be wide, and I find that encouraging because it's tough to get a conversation going, and this is where the Athletic Reform Group is important because, among other things, the members of the Athletic Reform Group are really well informed about how efforts have unfolded elsewhere, and so they are the group that I go to when I'm trying to think through these ideas to say, what does this look like? And they say, well, they tried to do that at Michigan, and it completely fell apart. And so that's, I think, a new role that for me, for my, why I keep coming back to the Athletic Reform Group is because the reform, this is a multi-generational issue, what to do with sports on college campuses. When you start to propose things in 2015, you find out it had been proposed in 1945 and then again in 1982. And things like freshman eligibility, should our first-year students be actually competing? That has come up again and again and again. And again, the Athletic Reform Group has got a set of members who are pretty well informed as to what's going on.
Well, wait a minute. I got to stop you here. I'm sorry. With all due respect to history, which I dearly love, what is stopping it from getting fixed? What do you mean you've thought about this? I mean, I see the name Reed Harris come up in stories and articles in The Atlantic. I mean, what's stopping this? I don't understand it, and I'm not an impatient person, but I also don't live within an academic setting. I live on the outside. I try to make things work. I have to move fast because that's kind of what happens in media. What's stopping us?
Well, I hate to be simplistic, but it's one word. It's one word, money. Money is what is keeping us from fixing these problems. There's more and more money flowing into the big-time sport enterprise all the time. And lots of people are profiting handsomely from that system. And many others, even if they're not profiting personally, are profiting in a sort of collective way in that they feel really good about rooting for their team. And they enjoy the kind of brand loyalty that comes with rooting for the Tar Heels or the Crimson Tide or the Wolverines. And so as the enterprise becomes bigger and bigger and coaches and administrators and NCAA officials are paid more and more money because the enterprise is bigger, you have to understand that the pushback is going to be fierce. The pushback from the defenders of the status quo is only going to get stronger, which is why, in my opinion, it really is going to take a kind of either a faculty coalition that draws a line in the sand and says it's really time to fix these problems, or a more general, you know, just cultural revulsion on the part of fans and the community at large. Once the community at large, and I mean the national community at large, is awakened to the moral outrages that are endemic in the big time sport enterprise at the moment, they will decide that something has to be done here.
So it's complicated. I feel that the money issue helps to understand the longevity of the problem. Mm-hmm. I feel that the hold of athletics at a university also has a lot to do with the way we are raising our children, and that we are, if you have had a girl who's played competitive volleyball, my son played soccer, and if you go to a tournament and you see several thousand parents spending all day watching their children and hoping that they will succeed, and then you add to that, especially, you know, the kids who are 10, 11, 12 years old, the parents worrying about how are they going to pay for their kids' college, that whole tuition thing, and thinking that she's such a terrific athlete, I really hope she gets an athletic scholarship that will get her respect and status, and it will save the family finances. I mean, to the extent that you have that kind of thinking going on, American families build their relationships with sports, and they build those relationships with their own children's play, and they build it cross-generational with cheering for teams at these universities. And so the commitments run really, really deep. And it is another reason that I feel my job as a college teacher is to buy some breathing room or find some breathing room for the students who have grown up in this world. And, you know, it's complicated, too, when you see what I've seen happen with my girls and their teammates coming through, and who in the end is going on to Division I play, and who has opted not to talk to coaches even though their talent might let them.
You're not going to believe this, but... There's this social network called LinkedIn, right? Mm-hmm. It's kind of like a professional Facebook thing. When our kid was, she's a setter. She was setting a Division I athlete who went on to Notre Dame. She happened to be a great student. Mm-hmm. And Emma's work, their statistics end up feeding in the sport of volleyball. Whoever sets the mm-hmm. point gets points too. Mm-hmm. So I had these coaches linking in invitations to me. And I was ignoring them mm-hmm. because Bill and I and Emma, we both, you know, we recognize that sports are great, but our family structure isn't built around that. Mm-hmm. But perhaps our audience here is a soft, sweet spot, mm-hmm. is that many of our listeners are women. We are responsible for making, opening up doors, suggesting ideas to our kids, our grandkids. And what you're saying to me, Rudy, is something so important. It's that where is our relationship with academics and athletics? What's more important? Mm-hmm. What benefits the child? What benefits the family? Mm-hmm. And you're asking us to examine that. Now, you truthfully, the cost of college for more than one kid alone, is pretty devastating.
Mm-hmm. It is. I feel like as kids go through high school, parents become more informed, and so it gets a richer, fuller picture about what the options are. But there is this moment, and it is a moment when they're really committing their kids. And if those kids are good and talented and they like it, then that becomes the horizons of their world. And for most, as you point out, you know, many do well in school and they do well on their teams, but they are still in an adult guided a competitive world that then sets up their lives on a college campus and sets up the decisions they're making at a college campus.
And truthfully, a college is disruptive. An intellectual environment disrupts and distorts what we've been told as children.
That's what's supposed to happen.
I know, yes. What happened to me. Mm-hmm. And my parents, bless them for knowing and sending me and steering me. I was a Greek and Latin major, so we weren't imbued in contemporary thought, but rigor of thought and skepticism. And it takes a great deal of courage to embrace skepticism. You know, I ask my listeners, suspend your belief. I ask them now, suspend your belief on this ARG. Whatever you do, this is not something to exert hostility towards. This is an invitation to the safety of trying to recognize when we have competing interests, how are we going to live? Because neither one are going away fast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would love for your listeners to see in the problems surrounding big-time sport at the moment grave moral issues that concern all young people and how we educate our young people and what sort of priorities we help to set for them and so on. But there's another issue we haven't even talked about it so far this morning, and that is a race issue, that the students who are so deprived, particularly in the revenue sports of football and basketball, The people who are so deprived of proper educations are disproportionately black. And we are therefore, in our big-time sport universities, perpetuating racial injustices and social inequities that, of course, aren't born when people arrive on a college campus. They go back to birth, and they go back past generations, of course. But these are issues that we need to think about holistically. We need to address them as moral issues, and we need to recognize that university sport programs have a responsibility to address these issues, and universities more generally have a responsibility to address these issues. And if they're perpetuating injustice, they have to think about that.
And I think the gravity of what you've said is clearly there's the inequality. But there's also an enormous sense of regret, because they are walking around a college campus and their families may not have had that benefit. So how do we learn more about ARG? How do we, our listeners, me, kind of stay in contact with what's happening besides inviting you both to come back?
Mm-hmm. Well, our infrastructure, our ARG infrastructure, is pretty primitive.
Okay.
We don't even have a website, I regret to say. And we do have a little listserv that the members of the organization use to stay in touch with one another. But really, the way to keep up with the ARG is simply to watch Faculty Council, because we do have now a fairly steady presence at Faculty Council. And the Faculty Executive Committee, led by Bruce Cairns, the new faculty chair, has been very receptive to us and is engaging us in dialogue, and we're very grateful for that. We have, we're making an impact. We're prying open a lid that was shut tight just a year or two ago. So
I want to thank you both.
Thank you, Leanne.
I look forward to having you back. I want to thank the listeners. I also want to thank the underwriter of our show, which is Videri Chocolate. To learn more, go to www.viderichocolatefactory.com. You've been listening to WCOM LP in Chapel Hill, Carrboro, North Carolina, and you've been tuning in to Courage Cocktail Radio Show. As always, you bring the lunch, and I'll bring the Courage Cocktail. Thanks for joining me. See you next week.